Welcome to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It is not much, but COVID numbers are starting to drop in Los Angeles County. New infections, the positivity rate, average daily case rates.
This downward trend is encouraging, and it signals that we're likely to have passed the peak of Omicron transmission and are beginning to see a real decline in the number of newly infected individuals.
That's Barbara Ferrer, who directs LA's Department of Public Health. Now, the numbers may be starting to creep down, but they're still very high. And there are plenty of battle scars to be found around Greater LA from this latest pandemic surge, at hospitals, in the workplace, and of course, at the places of learning. COVID numbers went through the schoolhouse roof for students and teachers at LAUSD, leaving some classrooms virtually empty. In an interview with NPR this week, incoming Superintendent Alberto Carvalho said he comes into the job hoping for balance after a rough few first weeks back.
I have to recognize that people are seeking normalcy. People are seeking routine. I think there's an appropriate way to establish a balance that resumes the routine that kids need, the normalcy they desire, without abandoning scientific principles that protect our schools and protect our communities.
LAUSD reports the positivity rate has dropped 10% since the return of students after the holiday break, and about 4 out of 5 students are in attendance on average this week. So let's get an update on how things are going at school with a couple of teachers we've been talking to over the course of this pandemic. Aviva Alvarez-Zaxon, Ms. Z as she's known, teaches world history and ethnic studies at Hamilton High off of Robertson. Hey, Aviva.
Hello. Thanks for having me again.
You bet. Christy Collette teaches third grade at Newcastle Elementary in Reseda. Hey, Christy, welcome.
Hey, thanks.
Aviva, I'm going to start with you. We have heard all kinds of stories. What has 2022 been like for you and your classes so far, going back in this semester now?
Oh, that's such a loaded question.
Yeah, it is.
The first 2 weeks already feel like it was 6 months ago, and this is week three. So it's been a bit of a lot. Classes were so empty that first, especially the first few days, but the first week and a half, I've only just started breaking like 70% attendance. Like, we're actually reaching closer to 80% attendance now, which is still extremely low, I should say. Like 80% attendance is nowhere near where we want to be, but that's where we're kind of starting to reach, except for a couple of my classes, which are still kind of in the 60s and 70s, depending on the day. It's been rough.
Okay. Do you know if the absences that you're talking about were because students actually had COVID, or maybe because some parents just wanted to keep their kids out of school while the numbers were high?
I know it was both. I know students who had COVID, students who were recovering from COVID, students who had inconclusive test results, students who were stuck internationally because of COVID, and then quite a few. And then it gets a little bit confusing because we have some students who have family members who are testing positive, but they themselves haven't. But they feel responsible, like they kind of feel like it'd be a more responsible choice to not come to school, even though that's not what this school says to do or the district says to do. And then we had a considerable number of students who were just scared, like their families were just scared to send them back, and they were communicative about that.
Yeah, there's so many layers to this, Christy. What about you? You teach younger kids? How have things been going at Newcastle Elementary?
We have definitely seen a huge improvement. Our baseline test, our school was at 23% positive rates. It's down to about 13% now. The first week, we had 120 students absent, which is about a third of the school. I personally, it hasn't been as bad in my class, but many school classrooms still have between 5 and 7 kids out. I haven't personally heard of any of our parents keeping them home because they're afraid to send them back to school. I do believe most of ours are due to positive tests.
And what about staffing at the school when we're talking about teachers and administrators? How is staffing over at Newcastle?
Well, that first week, every single credentialed person was sent to a classroom to cover for the lack of substitutes. So all of our intervention teachers, we do have a district office person who's been here who had to sub for a class today. So we've definitely been maxing out on the number of adults that we're putting into our classrooms.
But you say that's getting better too, now 3 weeks in.
Correct.
I mean, when I ask you this, I mean, because for both of you, and I'll get back to you in just a second, Aviva, but, you know, with younger kids and issues with staffing because of Omicron, I mean, what's been your biggest concern in recent weeks? Is it safety? Obviously, the safety for your own health and the health of the children. Is it not having enough staff on site? I mean, what would you say is the biggest thing? I'll ask you first, Christy, and then we'll get to Ms. Z.
For me, and we talked about this at lunch today, the biggest thing for us is it's just the big elephant in the room. Everything revolving around COVID, because these kids, it's still a constant cover your nose, cover your nose, cover your nose, wash your hands. As far as safety, the longer we're here, the safer I feel. I don't know if it's just because I'm adapting to it as opposed to the fear actually being gone.
Ms. Z, Aviva, what say you?
Yeah, I think it is just the elephant in the room. I think it is the it's the microscopic elephant in the room that we cannot see, but we know is here. I think that's been what's the hardest thing to really kind of grapple with. I mean, it's been the hardest thing since the beginning of the pandemic. This is a threat that I cannot see. I articulated to my students, I literally said as part of my job, I will do everything I can to protect you. And right now, the most present danger is one that we know is here and I cannot see it and I can't do anything except for remind you to wear a mask, wear mine, do what I can to make sure you're sitting in the same seats and all this other, all these other steps. I don't know, for me, I have this little mantra where I have not resigned to COVID, but I understand that it is just so present. And it kind of feels that the systems around us are just resigning to COVID. And that's been really hard to just be feeling like I'm doing all of this work and all of these steps to keep things as safe as possible. And the systems around me feel like they're just crumbling under the pressure and just letting COVID happen.
Yeah. I want to ask you, this is a little bit of outside the box, but I have talked to a couple of principals in the region at different school districts, and they have both told me things that I think are very important when it comes to protocol at the schools. One of which is one of the reasons why things got so janky, and maybe things still are janky at some of the schools, is because of the contact tracing issue. So you have a student with COVID who tests positive for COVID. You have to do contact tracing for the people, the children, staff members, all of those folks who were around that child. Is that correct?
Not anymore.
Not anymore?
No.
Explain that. How has that been changed?
As of Friday, the district announced that they are no longer going to be contacting parents of children who are considered close contact.
As of this Friday?
Yes. And I will tell you my reason that I believe is because they cannot possibly keep up. If we looked at all the kids who were considered close contact in the past 2 weeks, it is my entire class. So parents should just assume the principal is no longer contacting you. Assume that they have probably been a close contact
with somebody who has COVID.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And you hope that if you're taking the precautions, wearing the surgical mask, the KN95 or the N95, and you're at a reasonable distance from somebody close by, that you're not going to catch it, you'll be okay.
For me, yes. And honestly, for the kids inside class, I don't think is the issue. I think it's when they're at lunch.
Yeah. Aviva, are you seeing that too? So the contact tracing, that goes away on Friday. Has that been, I mean, from what I'm hearing all over the district and in other districts too, it's just been a pain in the neck.
Yeah, contact tracing is really I really commend all administrators who had to do contact tracing. It was a Herculean task that took away so much time from their nights and weekends. This last couple of weeks at our school, we had a system in place for contact tracing. I myself had to take almost an hour out of my Saturday or Sunday to help contact trace for the students that were in my classes because we all see 200 plus students in our days. Contact tracing, I did always kind of think that it was a little bit interesting that we were doing all this contact tracing, whereas students would eat lunch with whomever they wanted and obviously had to be unmasked. Students have significant others that they meet up with throughout the day, and we're not contact tracing them necessarily, which I always thought was quite interesting because those were the students that they actually had more contact with maskless. It also got a little bit interesting for sports teams. Like, how did that work out for close contact sports? It was just, it was always kind of interesting. But for my age group, the reins had been loosened a little bit with vaccinations. Like, vaccinated students didn't necessarily have to quarantine. And now we're just acting like everyone has been exposed, which is pretty true. We've all been exposed.
The last time I talked to both of you, you talked about your roles as teachers. Also now included being, you know, you're a social worker, you're a nurturer even, and students are dealing with the stress of not only school and learning and the lessons being learned, but also the emotional toll of the pandemic, some of whom have lost family members to it or have gone through so much, maybe someone in their family who lost a job. In the wake of this latest surge, what is morale like, Aviva, at your school? How are your students doing now, and how are you doing?
It varies from kid to kid, from anxiety level to anxiety level. I think the general sense is just exhaustion with this. It's really hard to keep coming back. I feel like every break we've had, we've left with a bit of hope that things are getting better, and we come back with actually they're no better or they're worse. And that's exhausting, especially as a teenager when you just want to get back to doing your teenage stuff, including school, but also, you know, your sports teams and going out and going to the movies and being able to eat popcorn freely, all that other stuff. It's exhausting. And I really have that kind of sense of just, like, everyone's shoulders are just slumped a little further forward. It's just tougher. Weirdly, I feel better than I did earlier this year. I don't know what it is. It's almost a sense of maybe because I started with so much anxiety, like I started the semester with so much anxiety, so much just dread about everything, just trying to maintain my own health while feeling responsible for the health of 230 people who I see every week. So it was just so much dread. And yet somehow I don't know, and maybe this grimly has made me stronger. This all has just made me stronger. Or we've just learned, maybe that this is just normal now. A pandemic is normal, and thus the fluctuations of a pandemic are like the fluctuations that we've had to deal with in the past, like election seasons and natural disasters and politics influencing our classrooms. Like, now it's just a virus.
Christy, what about you? How are you doing? How are your students doing amid all of this?
You know, mine are pretty good. We had a field trip planned for this past week that we had to cancel, so they were very upset about that. Overall, you know, at this age, it doesn't affect them as much as it does the older kids. They're not always aware of things like their parents' jobs or financial situations. But I think it's the exhaustion and almost like a complacency that we've got to, you know, while still being so careful and having them be so careful and wash your hands and sanitize. And we're trying to balance that without also freaking them out at the same time.
Aviva, how do you keep going through all of this? I mean, is there a silver lining?
Sanitizing, washing hands, masking, all the things that Christy reminds her students to do, and just trying to kind of keep myself together. I feel really lucky that I have so far gotten through a lot of this unscathed. So many of my colleagues haven't. Teachers are getting sick. I think we need to really remind everyone of this. Like, we are getting sick on the line of work, and their kids are teachers' kids are getting sick, and that's getting them. And while I think we can kind of rose over this, that there aren't outbreaks at school, I don't know anywhere else anyone is getting sick, and I think we should really just remember that. And like, maybe just like send your kids' teachers a nice little email saying, hey, just thank you, I appreciate.
What about you and your fellow teachers, Christy?
We have definitely had several teachers catch it, and unfortunately, the whole family, ended up with it, knock on wood for myself also. I have not. But yeah, I think, you know, we talk about giving the kids grace and giving the parents grace. And, you know, let's remember, let's give the teachers grace too.
I want to thank you both for talking to us. I know you've been through so much. Christy Collette, third grade teacher over at Newcastle Elementary. Aviva Alvarez-Zaxson, Ms. Z, world history and ethnic studies teacher over at Hamilton High. Thanks to you both. Good luck.
Thank you for checking in.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're headed back to West Adams. Yesterday, we told you about the city's Vision Zero program, which has failed to live up to its promise of reducing traffic and pedestrian deaths. Today, a look at some traffic safety measures that have been put in place in West Adams and why some locals feel mixed about them. You'll hear it coming up on the other side of this.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. A few years ago, many of the storefronts here on West Adams Boulevard were blighted. But now, right here, just south of the 10 freeway, you can spend more than $6 on a chocolate croissant at the latest outpost of the San Francisco-based bakery Tartine. And then a quarter mile down the road, there are plans to demolish a laundromat so that luxury apartments can be built, just across the street from a new boutique hotel. This is not the working and middle-class black and brown neighborhood Yolanda Davis Overstreet remembers from her childhood.
It's really not the same neighborhood in the end. It will not be the neighborhood we knew, that we grew up in. It is not even now.
Davis Overstreet is a community organizer. Most recently, she played a role in bringing crosswalks and bike lanes right here to this stretch of West Adams Boulevard.
This is a safety change that has been made for the very people that live and have been affected by traffic violence and a disenfranchised community that hasn't been improved for decades.
But as amenities here familiar to locals disappear and are replaced by services for upper-middle-class Angelenos, neighborhood improvements, even ones that benefit everyone, are sometimes regarded by old-timers with suspicion. Even these crosswalks have some folks wondering, who are these changes really for? KCRW's Megan Jamerson picks it up from here.
So, here we are, the famous Adams.
Davis Overstreet is standing at an intersection in West Adams with her arms wide looking out at fresh white lines and a bright yellow pedestrian sign of one of the new crosswalks.
You know, when I first crossed, it did kind of feel surreal that I don't have to run. It's very uplifting, you know, to know that there's a safety barrier here that's been created for us that live in this community.
The same 2 miles that are being rapidly developed today along West Adams were identified by the city 5 years ago after a shocking number of hit and runs killed black and brown elders. As part of Vision Zero, the city brought the street down to 2 lanes of traffic to slow down cars and add more crosswalks. With the extra space, they put in a bike lane. Sounds great if you walk around the neighborhood, right? But that's not what a neighbor recently told longtime local Stephen Meeks.
She said, this is just all part of gentrification, and it's not part of us having been here all these years, and why has it taken so long? And people have been saying that about the whole area. They're wondering, well, this is for us? This is not for us.
Making West Adams, quote-unquote, better can sound an awful lot like making it more attractive to outsiders.
When we say the words West Adams, what do we mean?
Daryl Wash is the CEO of Band of Vices, a black-owned art gallery on West Adams Boulevard. His family goes back 70 years in the area.
What we mean who grew up here is we mean the rich legacy and the and sort of the history and depth of culture that existed and sort of the Sugar Hill. What they mean is, hey, this is a hot new area to put some money into.
Sugar Hill is a nearby middle-class black neighborhood, much of which was bulldozed to make way for the 10th Freeway. Today, displacement is happening here again. The latest census data shows the neighborhood's black and Latino populations have dropped about 7% over the last decade, while Asian and white populations have increased.
We as a nation can afford to allow people who are not at the top end of the spectrum to stay in their communities, to live with dignity. We choose not to.
Davis Overstreet also has complicated feelings about the changes. Sitting with a small group of neighborhood homeowners, she describes the last time she went to Tartine.
It's a very perplexing reality, and it's like a part of me has this rage in it to wonder, where am I now? I was sitting at that bakery, and it was nothing but white people coming to that bakery. I didn't see me. I didn't see my community.
Her friend Stephen Meeks is sitting there now next to Davis Overstreet, nodding his head in agreement.
And in fact, I reached out to Stephen. It's like, please, you know, could you come down here, you know, and just sit at the table. It's not that I'm trying to jam white folks, but I don't think they understand what it feels like, you know, to have a community that has been disenfranchised and we made it work. And now it's like who we are and what we are don't matter anymore because it's changing. And that's the way it feels at times.
We're expendable.
Yes. Invisible.
Meeks is also a community organizer with the neighborhood's Good Earth Community Garden.
The people in this neighborhood, I don't care if you're what color you are. If you live here, you're expendable. And do you want to sell your house?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we get all these... Not lately, people come into the door, but in the mail, phone calls, texts about selling our house, you know.
That's Laura Kleins, another longtime resident and retired LAUSD administrator. Kleins says these offers don't feel like a good deal because there's nowhere to go. While rents have shot up in West Adams and are pushing people out, even homeowners who can cash out feel pressured to leave. Kleins lives in her childhood home with her 95-year-old mother. When her mom dies, the plan is to sell and split the profits of the three-bedroom home with her siblings. Her parents bought the house in 1962 for around $25,000. Now it's easily worth over $800,000. Kleins planned to use that money to stay in West Adams, but the reality of that dream is slipping away.
To stay in the neighborhood is unaffordable for me. I'm retired. And I think when the time comes, I'm going to have to probably leave Los Angeles because it's just too expensive.
And that's the unfortunate thing about people that have been here.
Yeah.
That should not happen.
West Adams homes are still affordable for some Angelenos, like Jennifer Lee and her partner, who moved here 3 years ago.
We were living in West LA, which is impossible to buy. So, yeah, we purchased a house in West Adams.
Lee is a financial planner and says the affordability, the central location, and the neighborhood feel sold her on the area. But Lee says she doesn't feel like a gentrifier.
I don't know if I necessarily see myself as trying to change the neighborhood personally, but I mean, I think my understanding is the neighborhood has gotten safer, and I don't know if that's necessary because of gentrification, but just new people coming into the neighborhoods.
Lee's noticed the changes, like the new restaurants and apartment buildings. Those feel like gentrification to her. The other improvements, like the new crosswalks and bike lane, don't. Davis Overstreet, who played a large role in bringing these safety improvements to West Adams, agrees.
So those are two different efforts. It was a community member effort doing what I did, and then there's the business improvement effort that's come as a result of the gentrification that's happening.
Davis Overstreet is back on West Adams Boulevard. She's walking by another new crosswalk, which she sees as proof of the power of community action.
And at least we can stand up, hold our hand up and say, I know that this activity took place as a result of my voice as a person that lives in the community.
She hopes more of the changes to come in West Adams are the kind that truly benefit everyone and make it easier and more comfortable for the longtime community to thrive. For KCRW, I'm Megan Jamerson.
going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, we go fly fishing with LA Times columnist Pat Morrison along the LA River. No, we're not fly fishing, but we do go to the Los Angeles River, to the Great Herring Gates and the banks of the river where rollerbladers, skateboarders, runners, cruisers, and all sorts of Angelenos gather to revel in its unnatural, natural beauty. That's a term from Pat's best-selling book that we're going to talk about tomorrow on this program on GLA. Always online, by the way, at kcrw.com/GLA. Share your feelings with us. Tell us how you're doing. And, of course, get the podcast at the website, kcrw.com/GLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Taha, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all help with the show tonight. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thank you for your time and attention. Have a great night.